and it applies to our situation in capitalism in the United States right now. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for watching and listening to this program, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
The time now is 7 p.m., almost 1 minute past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York. It's 7 o'clock, actually 7:01. It's time for another edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only the bombs for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood, but did you know?
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined by Kyle.
Yes, present.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Gila.
Greetings and salutations.
And Alex.
Good evening.
Well, who wants to have some fun? Okay, they can't see you raising your hand, all right? So you got to answer audibly. It's radio.
I'm opting out.
Okay, so those of you who really want to have fun, say so. Those of you who are just saying you want to have fun, say so as well, so we know the difference.
So.
Okay, good. Some of us want to have fun. And if you're a listener and you want to have fun as well, this is what we suggest. Go on over to a site called governmentaddict.org and read along with us some of the comments that we're just finding out about that have been released. FCC complaints from Trump fans. Come on, that's a whole night of entertainment. We're only going to spend a couple of minutes on it. But basically, these are the same people who have been raging against cancel culture. And they have basically been spending the last 4 years, this is according to Vice News, demanding that the federal government cancel Saturday Night Live for being mean to Donald Trump. This has been obtained via the Freedom of Information Act, and it's hosted on Government Addict, which is found at governmentaddict.org. And we're going to read a few of them. Gila, did you have something you wanted to add?
I did. I just wanted to confirm if it was government attic, like the roof, or government addict, like hooked on.
Well, you just gave me an idea for a great site for confused people to land on, but it's attic. It's like the room in your house that you don't talk about.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. So here are some quotes. Cancel culture has to be stopped. But you cannot allow on any broadcast a depiction slash insinuation slash outright demonstration of a leader of the United States being assassinated, wrote one viewer in 2019 after Michael Che delivered a John Wilkes Booth joke during Weekend Update. I remember that joke. It was funny. I'm personally all for freedom of speech. Here we go. And if a 33-year-old woman feels that making fun of a 10-year-old boy empowers her and gives her equality, well, I don't agree with it, but if that's what she needs to get her through the night, so be it. I have no idea what they're talking about. I, however, don't need to see this moron or the network, NBC, that's supporting her prosper from it. And considering I now pay for these once-free networks on my cable bill, I would like for you to consider revoking their license or substantially fining them. Okay, I think I know what this is in reference to. There was a writer for SNL that made a joke about Trump's underage son. It was just a joke. It wasn't anything horrible. But kind of off limits. Kids are off limits. Yeah, I think we all agree to that. And I think she was fired. So that's really the whole story right there. And it wasn't on air. It was something that was done off air. Here's another comment. SNL aired a racist statement on their Weekend Update segment calling Trump a bitch and a cracker, which is a highly racist term for whites. Yeah, on behalf of whites, let me just say we are deluged with so many racist attacks. It's just so harmful to us. It's prevented us from doing all the things that we wanted to do over the past 1,000 or so years. So please, stop being racist to us. Thank you. I find all racism to be highly inappropriate and offensive. Also, calling the president a bitch is not comedy that should be aired on TV. Apparently, that really rubs some people the wrong way. And here are a couple more. They really latched onto Michael Che calling the president a cracker. This racial slur is offensive to every non-racist American, regardless of race, ethnicity, or skin color. That's just a fact, apparently. Calling a white man a cracker is the same thing as calling a black man. No, it is not the same thing. And they actually said it, too. Oh, my God. The fact that you would say that shows how clueless so many of us remain. Unbelievable. On the September 30th, 2017 broadcast of Saturday Night Live, during the news report segment, the person used a racial slur cracker in regards to President Trump. This is wholly inappropriate, and I would appreciate a response wherein you detail exactly what will be done regarding punishment to the person that said it and the production company that aired it. They are on a tape delay specifically to be able to catch things like this, and they allowed it to go over the air. This makes them complicit in the act. Thank you, and have a nice day. for some reason, they saved the emphasis to the end there. Blatant sexual innuendo to masturbation has completely crossed the line into obscenely disrespectful comments about President Trump. Yeah, if anything came out of the last 4 years, it's that. Effective immediately, I will boycott all advertisers on NBC and communicate my outrage to each and every one of them. I am also sending this complaint to the FCC for immediate follow-up. This was a complaint to the FCC, so I'm not really sure how that happened. Comedians, this is a different one, even comedians such as CNN's use of an SNL skit is being used to insult a president of the United States. That's the most clumsy sentence I think I've ever read. In my younger days, networks and broadcasters feared and followed FCC rules on their content as these rules protected the public from the trash we now have. They were careful not to offend because we have laws. Wow. All right, we can't do this all night, but you can. You can certainly go to governmentaddict.org and read some of those. Let me just finish with this one because it's classic. Another watershed moment that sent people rushing to complain was Jim Carrey's Joe Biden. Yeah, they were upset by that. He used the word goddamn. Goddamn. This really apparently is offensive to some people. NBC ran a Saturday Night Live election special on Monday evening, November 2nd. One of the skits had Jim Carrey playing Joe Biden and Alec Baldwin playing President Trump. It was a funny skit, and my wife and I were laughing at some of the lines until Jim Carrey uttered an obscenity by taking the Lord's name in vain. I told my wife that there was no reason for him to use that language. Why did you have to tell your wife there was no reason? Can she think for herself? It didn't add anything to the skit. These words are deeply offensive to me, and I'm sure that other people of faith feel the same way. And some people of faith did feel the same way and did write in. Here's one more. It was Saturday night. I thought it was Monday night, so they can't even agree on what day it aired. I just got home from my second job, and my daughter and I were headed to bed, and he said it so loudly and with such emphasis that my daughter looked at me like, "What was that?" Jim Carrey as Joe Biden saying goddamn so loud that it startled this girl and she didn't know what it was. I turned off the TV immediately and the next day searched the internet to see if that had created an uproar as I thought it would, but it had not because we're in the 21st century, not the 18th century. I didn't think such words were allowed on TV. Well, you learn something. You learn that they are. Goddamn, 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 they are. Wow. Oh, and radio, too. And we're the station that sort of proved which words are and aren't allowed by FCC rules. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, just speaking as another member of the broadcast media, as, you know, those of us are, you know, if Trump didn't want Saturday Night Live doing things like this, maybe he shouldn't have been such a goddamn cracker.
Wow. You didn't say bitch. Well, that's good. That's good for you. Go ahead, Alex.
Hey, look, putting aside the merits of the complaints about criticizing this, the poor little supposed billionaire president of the United States, I mean, you have to hand it to these Trump supporters, on the other hand, to actually go through the motions of making an actual FCC complaint. I mean, even though it seems trivial and idiotic, at least it's a form of civic engagement, which is doing a hell of a lot more than posting some kind of quote-unquote hot take on Twitter about this. So, well, on the other hand, I my hat's off to these people for actually going through.
Hold on a second. You're saying it's better than posting something on Twitter, but it's basically the same thing because they're going to a web form and simply posting the same words that they probably would have posted on Twitter anyway.
I disagree. I don't think it's – I think it's a hell of a lot more involved than going to Twitter and posting some kind of, you know, hot take that is just there for retweets or likes or, you know, whatever it is. This is something that goes directly over to a government agency and they have to review it.
Well, yeah, it does that, but they don't do that. All they do is type the same words into a different form. I mean, yeah, they're doing something by doing that, but yes, they're not writing a letter. They're not going to the post office and mailing something. They're not even calling anybody on the phone. I mean, well, you know, that's how it works. It's not really their fault. That's
the official channels of the United States government to make a complaint to a federal agency about something that they care about. And frankly, I think more people on the left should be doing this about issues that we care about. We were as dedicated and less, I think, less obsessed with social media. I think that, you know, maybe we'd get a hell of a lot more done.
Well, I'm not sure you're being fair here, because we certainly do. Remember net neutrality, how many comments were filed with the FCC, and we found all the fake ones that were filed with the FCC. So certainly a lot of people are engaged and trying. It's just this is the way that people do it these days.
And I would, in fact, argue that there's perhaps even a dilution to a degree in some of these being a bit well, it's personal grief, a gripe from an individual viewer, of course, but I think by having such a volume that don't really have something that's sincerely against any kind of FCC guidance, it kind of makes the submission just sort of a bit spammy, right? But more in the bureaucratic sense. Do you agree with that, Alex? Or do you think, I don't know, do you think each of these is really taken that seriously, given a large amount of submissions? And likewise on the left, you know?
I think you're right. I agree with it to a certain degree. Because, look, if you overwhelm a federal agency with this, you know, this non-substantive, a mess of these non-substantive complaints that they have to review and assess and respond to if need be, I mean, that's a form of denial of service attack, frankly, right? You know, you're preventing the staffers, you're using their resources, you are limiting the ability of that particular federal agency to get other work done with the resources that they have at hand. So, yeah, I agree. I mean, these complaints should be substantive, but I do think, you know, hey, at least they did something. We should hand it over to DC. I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah,
and I know.
Well, I hope the devil's paying you well. The point is, they what they're calling for, that is what I wanted to focus on. The fact that they because somebody criticizes the president or mocks him or says, you know, a word which is in common usage, they want things shut down. They want things canceled. They want things to go away. And it's very important to identify that kind of mentality that wants basically to control how we speak and how we think, because that is unfairly put on the left way too many times, that they want to control your kids and what you think and what you say and whether you get a shot and things like that. And it's completely unfair because they are the number one people that do that. They're constantly calling for control. They've had control for so long. And anytime they see something that in any way runs afoul of that, they call for blood in whatever way they can. Go ahead, Rob.
We were talking just The complaints in here, and I'm looking at this file, and the complaints in here about what Katie Rich, who was the writer on Saturday Night Live, who tweeted a joke about Barron Trump and was suspended for it, the fact that they were complaining to the FCC about that reminds me a lot of the story we were talking about, I believe it was last week, where a school wanted to punish a student for things she was doing outside of school jurisdiction, off school grounds, just comments she was making on, I think, Snapchat or whatever it was. And, you know, the FCC has its purpose, has its purview, but it's kind of fascinating that people saw somebody who works in television do something that they were offended by on Twitter and therefore complain to the FCC.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the FCC basically would get involved in a writer saying something that wasn't on the air in the first place that they consider to be you know, out of bounds. Go ahead, Gila.
No, I absolutely agree, but I also, elsewhere in the thing, I saw my favorite complaint at all, which is SNL said the F word, please put them in jail. So, you know, they had like a plan. I think it was everybody. They wanted to put everybody in jail. Was that the plan?
I guess the entire show.
Everybody. But no, it's, I agree with Rob. I think it very much echoes the cheerleader story in that where is the line? And absolutely correct that when it's not coming from the left, the right's like, oh yes, why do I have to hear this? I don't want to. Make it go away.
And make everybody else not be able to hear it as well. Well, yeah, we just found out this week that Trump wanted to execute the person who leaked the information that he, his wife, and his son went to the bunker during the Black Lives Matter protest at, in D.C. He wanted to execute somebody for leaking that information. When you consider all the other information about him that has been leaked and all the other criticism that has come out against him over the years, execution for that mild transgression, you have to really get into their minds and realize what a danger they are if you give them this kind of power. All right. Well, that's just an amusing anecdote, something to spend some time on. Here's something else that I think might be a bit problematic. You know, all these ransomware attacks and intrusions and bad security that we report on week after week. Well, a top lawyer for America's Cyber Warrior Force. Yeah, we have a Cyber Warrior Force. It sounds kind of silly, but they're calling publicly for military operations against transnational criminal hackers. Kurt Sanger is Marine Lieutenant Colonel, serving as General Counsel at U.S. Cyber Command, and that, by the way, is the Cyber Warrior Force that we alluded to. In an article published on Lawfare.com, that's Lawfare.com, disruptions from ransomware and other criminal hacking threats have become so harmful to national security that using military force against them with lines of code, not bombs and bullets, as weapons is justified and legal. Well, what do you think, Alex? I mean, I don't know what the difference is, really. If it's lines of code, it's a hacking attack, it sounds like. What makes it a military hacking? Because the military are the ones hacking their systems? And how far are we from them saying, you know what, forget the code, let's go back to the bombs and bullets, because that's not working and we have to show real force?
Well, yeah, I think what Lieutenant Colonel Sanger is driving at when he's suggesting lines of code rather than kinetic force is the principle of proportionality. Because if we are to consider a ransomware event or some kind of influence operation or a breach of, let's say, critical infrastructures as networks, some form of active war, then we can only respond to that in a proportional manner. You know, these are essentially international norms that apply to the law of warfare. This is something I spent some time studying many years back. And so if we're responding with lines of code to essentially lines of code that would arguably be proportional based on whatever the actual response was. But this kind of thing has been, this idea rather, has been swirling around for quite a while. Back in, God, I think it was 11 years ago, I gave a talk at St. Mary's University at the Center for Terrorism Law on what's known as active defense, or essentially hacking back, right? Taking these proactive stances and hacking back. And 11 years ago, I argued that this was a bad idea. I think it's still necessarily a bad idea. And if we are to respond militarily, even with lines of code, to some kind of ransomware event, I think we have to be damn sure, you know, from an intelligence and a military perspective, that this was an act that was sponsored or sanctioned or in some way associated officially with a foreign government intended to disrupt the United States' critical infrastructure or some kind of critical service or function that could affect lives, that could affect people physically. Because there are so many influence operations or so many ransomware events that they may be the states may turn a blind eye to these, or they may be acting in a way that could be seen to benefit one particular state. But without direct evidence tying us to an official action of, let's say, a government minister, a department, or an agency of a foreign power, I think it's very, very dangerous for us to venture down this road, because based on that same principle of proportionality, this very same thing could be done to us in the future. And we are not the only – I'm sorry, we're not just a victim here. Let's think about the United States as sometimes as an aggressor. These are things that are not reported or very often caught. But, you know, we have our own very effective offensive cyber operations, and we certainly would not want to start this kind of tit-for-tat between government agencies of foreign power.
Well, I agree with what you say, but I wonder – the way these stories are being reported every single day, we always hear it's coming from Russia, it's coming from China, it's coming from Iran, even North Korea. Are we not already going down that road of attaching blame, whether it's through the media, through the military, and the only thing absent now is what the appropriate retaliation is? You know, it seems to me that a lot of this data can be faked, and it can be it can appear to be coming from one place when it's coming from another, or one state can implicate a different state, and there are many ways to get fooled in this environment.
Oh, I completely agree with that entirely, especially since, you know, the TTPs of one nation, you know, may be very, very well known. The TTP stands for the tactics, techniques, and procedures of one nation, you know, can be easily imitated by another nation. And so this just, I think, really gets to the issue of attribution and where it's important, right? Now, it's attribution of who's doing what is extraordinarily important. If you're telling a story, if you are the media, you want to have some kind of attribution that, let's say, North Korea was behind this, or this originates from Ukraine, because otherwise you don't really have a story. It's very hard to report on cyber security issues without having some form of attribution, which leads, unfortunately, in my opinion, to some less than stellar attribution. And that can be extraordinarily dangerous, because if it's not based on hard evidence and it's based on, let's say, flimsy TTPs that can be imitated by another country, that can essentially be a false flag, you know, yes, then we're going down this road where we may, in our minds, be convinced that, let's say, North Korea is behind this when, in fact, who knows, maybe it was Thailand or another, you know, Asian country. And so, yeah, I think it's dangerous. It's also very dangerous, I think, to consider these things too easily to be acts of war.
Well, the fact that it's been more overt, I think, is a key takeaway or aspect of this, that there's more talk of it. It perhaps is something that has been investigated and things may have been strategized and so forth in a much quieter sense, but there has been this, like, geopolitical sort of posturing in rhetoric. I do think, speaking to your proportionality comment, there's a little bit of uncertainty, I think, and sort of cascading impacts when things are deployed as a weapon, including blowback, people using the same tools, and you know, finding out about how your offensive capabilities are operating. So that, I think, also speaks to it being more of this sort of in the rhetoric, and of course the effects of it. I don't know. I mean, do we want to continue to escalate in cyberspace? Because, yeah, there's responding, but, you know, is continuing down that path the real kind of solution versus increasing security or awareness? I mean, I think all of those things are going on simultaneously, too.
Well, increasing security, obviously, is the most important thing because, you know, if you attack Russia for some reason because somebody from Russia let ransomware loose on a critical server, you're not necessarily attacking the right people. There are a lot of people in Russia. You don't know that everybody united together and decided to do this against this particular entity. And in the end, you still have an insecure system. You haven't fixed it. That is the most important thing, to be able to prevent this from happening in the first place. Have we given up? Have we said that it's not possible to stop ransomware, to stop these people from getting access to our critical servers? Because what if they didn't unleash ransomware? What if they just nestled in and observed? Wouldn't that be a whole lot more dangerous? We wouldn't know who was in there, and they have access to all this information for years, decades even. It's kind of a wake-up call. I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's not like benevolent hackers that basically uncover certain security holes and let the world know about them. This, obviously, it's profit-driven. But at least you know that you've got a problem, and hopefully we'll do something about it. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you hit on a really important topic here, too, which is that in not every instance of a breach is ransomware deployed on a network. This is something that happens frequently, and I think and have argued publicly that I think it's going to happen more frequently in the short term. Things are going to get worse before they get better. But what you described, Emmanuel, is essentially a form of persistence. If an adversary, some kind of cyber adversary, obtains access to a network, let's say it's a company's network, an organization's network, and they sit there and they wait, they establish persistence, they move around laterally, they're collecting information, that's essentially an intelligence gathering operation. That happens more often than not. And ransomware, we've seen, especially within the last year or so, can be deployed essentially as an anti-forensic tool. So that, let's say this adversary is discovered in a company's network and they want to burn traces of whatever their activities are. You know, they want to prevent the company from trying to figure out what they've been touching, what they've been doing. Deploying ransomware in that particular instance is a really effective way to distract from whatever their activities were and potentially destroy a lot of the evidence of the files that they read and touched. So ransomware can happen in the wake of, let's say, an intelligence gathering operation. And bringing it back, I think, to the article here with Lieutenant Colonel Sanger, on the other hand, in some instances, I think cyber operations are certainly justified in response, but it has to be on the basis of extraordinarily clear evidence. I don't always believe that restraint is the best option of the United States. But what I think we need to get away from, especially when it comes to countries like Russia, if we want to deter foreign actors, and they may not be state actors. These are very often criminal organizations that are sanctioned by a particular state that may have the unintended consequence of harming U.S. interests, which helps, let's say, Russian interests, where to the extent that we are made to look silly and weak when it comes to cyber operations, that helps the Russians, and it also gives them a reputation boost in allowing the rest of the world to think that they are so effective when it comes to something like misinformation, disinformation, as well as compromising other systems.
But couldn't it also be criminal organizations within those countries? I don't really care about those countries, but only themselves?
Absolutely. And so long as they're leaving their countries of origin alone, their governments will often turn a blind eye and refuse to prosecute them for those particular activities. That's why you see a lot of ransomware checking native language settings so that, you know, if your character sets are in Cyrillic or your language is Russian, it won't deploy ransomware, which, you know, gives rise to the option of, you know, hey, if you want to try to prevent the deployment of certain types of ransomware, just set your language setting to Cyrillic.
I never heard that before. That's really clever.
I'm curious also if we need to be so formal, because if the proportional response is sort of doing what they're doing to us, well, shouldn't criminal hacking gangs from America be activated and out there doing their wild best to cause all kinds of havoc? You know, as
there are no criminal hacking gangs in the United States, it is not a problem here.
Oh, I forgot about that speech.
Not a speech. Continue.
But, you know, when it comes to trying to deter this type of activity, you know, a colleague of mine, with whom I clerked, actually, Matt Rajansky, wrote an interesting article about this. And he is a Russian diplomacy expert, and that he had argued essentially that under the table, and I think softer diplomacy with Russia, as I understand his argument to be, is much more effective at trying to change behaviors of the Russian state than being so overt and doing something on social media and setting these bright lines in the sand. Because if we try to embarrass Russia, that's only going to embolden Putin and other Russian ministers to be seen even more as a strong man in the particular situation. So the more we try to embarrass them, the more lines we draw in the sand, the more likely they are to cross those particular lines. And that under-the-table diplomacy, where we don't necessarily try to embarrass the Russian state or claim that there's going to be major consequences, you know, if they continue to do this, that, or the other thing, would arguably be more effective.
Well, Alex, what you describe is true of almost any conflict. If you dig your heels in and try to embarrass somebody, they're going to do the same. Diplomacy tends to yield more positive results.
And my only point was that if you sort of create it as a nationalistic fight, this sort of adversarial thing, you will get vigilantism in certain ways. And it's a little along the lines of how you're saying, yeah, you think maybe not always the response is restraint and quiet. I feel like a lot of what we've covered over my whole life, I mean, just the whole history of it is, you know, doing this thing is going to get you in trouble, or, oh, the big corporate entity is going to be mad at you, and now it's being weaponized. So, like, these skills, these interests, these, I don't know, obsessions, all of a sudden have this, like, strategic value, something that people were told is like, oh, that'll get you in trouble, or you have to be careful, or all these things we warn and try to encourage and keep people out of trouble in telling them, you know, about being curious, about figuring out systems, about reporting things. That whole wave of responsibility, I feel, is entirely more responsible than sort of this recklessness and talking about it as something that we can be proportional about. I mean, there are unforeseen impacts, and when you're talking about different systems and complex systems, I don't know, that combined with a sort of nationalistic vigilantism in the air could lead to some unforeseen consequences.
And by the way, and something that might be related to all this, according to the New York Times, websites on the dark web used by a hacker, criminal hacking group in Russia, known as Revil, I believe is the way to pronounce it, used by them to negotiate payment with victims and provide customer support for people trying to transfer bitcoins to the criminals. They went dark early yesterday morning. They just went away. So, hey, maybe diplomacy is working. Maybe Russia's cracking down. If they are, in fact, in Russia, maybe something like that is happening. Of course, I don't know what happens to the people who are in the middle of trying to negotiate to get their data back. But interesting development. Did you hear about that, Alex?
Yeah, I did hear about it. I mean, look, it could be any number of things. I don't think anybody has pinpointed exactly what happened to Revil or R-Evil or however the hell you say this particular criminal organization's name. But it could be any number of things. It could be some kind of strategic pinpoint offensive hacking back strike that Lieutenant Colonel Sanger has been espousing on in his Lawfare article. But look, if it was one of these things, I think, you know, going back to that article, what it fails to appreciate as well is that if we are going to be fighting back with lines of code and exploits and that, well, these types of exploits, especially zero-day exploits that are unreported or unknown, if we use these up to fight back every kind of ransomware event, we're going to burn through them really, really quickly. I mean, these are extremely valuable exploits and vulnerabilities that we can use over long periods of time to collect extraordinarily valuable intelligence of the exact sort that you had just mentioned, Emmanuel, of sitting and waiting and watching data flows, you know, sniffing out traffic on networks, doing whatever the hell we want to do on an adversary's network if we can maintain persistence in there through. But we shouldn't be burning through these zero days. I think it really fails to appreciate the scarcity with which these quote-unquote cyber weapons are developed.
Yeah, sometimes the wisest move in a card game is to not show your hand. Actually, what card game?
Yes.
What card game is that where you don't show your hand? I'm sure this is a strategy that somebody uses somewhere.
Where you do or you don't?
You don't. You hold on to it. Well, you save it for a special occasion, which I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, maybe go fish.
I don't play cards. I don't know. But yeah, you know, we're talking about retribution of a equal sort, but there are people who want to take an actual military response. Many of them are the same people that complained to the FCC over SNL. They want to nuke the bastards for taking down their website or something like that. And, you know, we see that kind of disproportionate response in many parts of our average lives. But, you know, video games is another avenue where there's all kinds of abuse. Recently, there's a game called Warzone, which, as predicted, causes all kinds of conflicts. Warzone players are reporting a very odd glitch or hack this week, which is causing them to instantly reach account level 1,000 and have all their skins and calling cards unlocked. They have calling cards in this game. The hack appears to take place inside particular hacked lobbies. Okay, some have surmised that the level 1,000 jump takes place when you kill a cheater inside the hacked lobby, though this fact has not been confirmed yet. I don't know if the cheater is part of the game or is that somebody who hacked the game and you somehow figured it out and somehow killed him. The entire situation is reminiscent of old-school hacked lobbies on consoles during the Modern Warfare 2 era. You realize there's a whole universe out there. There's a Modern Warfare 2 era. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but there are people who... You know about this?
It's a video game.
I'm sure it is a video game, but there are people who measure time based on that era. It's not World War I, World War II, you know. No, it's Modern Warfare 2. That's how they live their lives.
There's Gears
and
of War.
There's nothing wrong with that, you know. There's nothing... Because that reality is... as silly as our reality, I'm sure. Anyway, my point is, with these particular hacks and basic foul-ups of video games and virtual worlds, there are people who get very incensed and want to fight back, and sometimes want to fight back for real. I mean, you know, we've seen people get kicked out of IRC channels who threaten all sorts of vengeance. You know, at some point, we have to realize, hey, this is just a game. This is just a computer. This is reality. This is real life. Let's not cross over too easily between all of this without understanding what it is exactly that we're dealing with. And let's try to understand as much of it as possible. I should know more about video games. I will be the first to say that. My education on that is woefully pathetic. But... I do know the difference between the virtual world and the real world. And I think, you know, once we establish that, we might be able to appreciate and understand each of those environments rather than dismiss them. Does that make any sense? Nobody thinks it makes any sense? You're all nodding your heads. People on the radio can't see that.
It makes its own kind of sense. It's like I'm a big fan of Doctor Who. It's a television show, and just today there was a post on a forum that went by me about how somebody like has had it with the drama in the fandom online and forums and message boards and things so much that they can't enjoy the actual show anymore. And you know, when internet drama is interfering with your ability to sit down and watch television and have a good time, maybe it's time to have more of a separation between what's going on the net and in real life.
Well, why don't people just sit down and watch television? Why do they need to get on the internet and you know? I know we want to be social and all that, but if it's not causing you joy, why do it? You know, just make it a private activity that you enjoy with yourself or friends or, you know, a trusted few. But you're always going to find idiots in any scenario. So I wouldn't give them that power.
Yep.
Okay.
I just think you're speaking as well to like this handing it over to the handing over breaches and some of this stuff so quickly over to the military handling it, because they're well equipped to escalate into weapons and things that ordinary security companies or software makers don't have access to. So who decides when things need to become out of the realm of that warfare?
Well, it's a microcosm.
I think if they're calling all the shots because we're trusting them in every little way, I think that's foolish. You know, it speaks to
It's you know, a microcosm. You know, us as individuals. You know, you get kicked out of a chat room or defriended by somebody, and your reaction is to attack the school that did it or somebody in the school that did it. You know, physically. That is the unhealthy society that we live in now, where we take these disproportionate reactions to fairly trivial events. What I consider to be very, but I know that people take them very seriously. But there is a point where you have to say, okay, got to calm down a little bit, got to put this in perspective, and do something else for a little while. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that everything needs to be put into perspective for sure, but if there's going to be some kind of kinetic response, I think there could possibly be a situation where there's a kinetic response to something that happens in quote-unquote cyberspace. That's certainly possible, given how vulnerable critical infrastructure is and how it can affect the physical health and safety of real human beings. But if there is to be any kind of kinetic response, I don't think we can simply just hand this over to the military, who's seems to be having a bit of an itchy trigger finger to use some of these offensive cyber operations that are in their arsenal, because anything that we do is going to be precedent setting for every other nation on this planet.
Right.
And we need to very, very well document the rationale, the evidence, the reasons, the proportionality, and I think our intended consequences of whatever our response is to a particular cyber attack or a cyber-related event, because that's going to be used to justify operations and actions between every other single country whenever anything similar happens, which will be on a daily basis for the foreseeable future.
And especially when things like attribution are already murky in this, you don't want to be like having trust in people that might be manufacturing it or that it isn't verified and totally known.
Okay, I want to move on to another story because this will likely take us to the end of the hour. And again, you can join us on our YouTube channel, Channel 2600, at 8 o'clock for Off the Hook Overtime, where you can call us and communicate with us. We are not on next week, so this is your last chance for a couple of weeks to be able to do that. Okay, so this story is interesting. A hacker working for a security firm got the shock of their life last month when they stumbled across what appeared to be a Middlebury College employee's stash of child pornography while hunting for vulnerable computers. It's not clear from this if they were working for the security firm when they hacked into the system or whether they were freelancing. I'm also not sure where Middlebury College is. Anybody know where Middlebury College is? You do, Alex?
Yeah, that's in Vermont. It's on the 802.
The hacker, that's where our phone number is. Wow, that's kind of funny. The hacker was faced with a moral quandary about law enforcement, alert law enforcement to their findings and risk criminal charges for hacking, or say nothing and live with a guilty conscience, knowing a possible child abuser is on the prowl. So they found a picture of the alleged voyeur's driver's license on his computer. And they decided to take a chance with law enforcement and turn the man in. That's according to an affidavit obtained by the Daily Beast. By so doing, the hacker revealed they had broken into the computer and had likely violated the law, but the gamble paid off. Prosecutors eventually offered the hacker immunity for their cooperation, and the alleged voyeur, who was a senior technology specialist for apparently not good enough for Middlebury College in Vermont, and yes, you're right, Alex, was arrested for possessing child porn. And the court documents do not identify the security researcher whose involvement is somewhat convoluted. Upon finding the explicit images, the hacker who was hunting for machines vulnerable to a specific kind of flaw as part of their work with a security research group, so I guess that answers my question, established backdoor access to the computer before handing off the case to law enforcement. They claim they did so out of a fear that law enforcement officials might not be able to properly investigate the child pornography if they lost access to the trove of pornographic files. Then the hacker submitted a report to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that they observed the suspect communicating with a young girl named Jeannie over a Tor network. The researcher told the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children they suspected the person was either sharing explicit images with Jeannie or in a relationship with her. Okay, interesting story. Do you think this hacker did the right thing? Are we comfortable with this kind of, I guess it is a form of surveillance in the fact that somebody can access your computer. I'm not sure if it's an office computer or a home computer. I'm suspecting it's something that was part of the university. But basically, looking at your files, seeing something that is not acceptable, and reporting you for it. Alex, does this stand up legally?
I mean, I think, yeah, legally it'll stand up for sure. And, you know, the really tricky thing is, you know, this hacker, this person reporting it, obviously could get themselves in trouble, negotiated some form of immunity in order for the report to be taken as evidence. And this is a really interesting complement to the last issue that we were discussing, because this is a form of active measure here, right? This is about going and crossing that line, using some kind of offensive technique, establishing backdoor access to an individual's computer and reporting that individual to law enforcement. I mean, look, it's definitely crossing the line, but here, especially when we're talking about children and the exploitation of children, the active dissemination of child pornography, there seems to have been a moral imperative to act in one way or another. Now, I think what's interesting to me about this story, though, is why the reporter, why the hacker, the security researcher, whatever we want to call him, had to do it without any kind of anonymity. Why couldn't he simply report that at this IP address or on this network there is a particular machine that contains child pornography and leave it at that without having his or her name associated with it or his company's name associated with it? And I think it was because that this hacker felt, again, this very strong moral imperative to preserve the evidence by establishing that back door, and thereby may have created evidence that led back to himself or herself.
Well, if I had to guess, I'd say that they probably felt that it would be ignored or just glossed over in some way, you know, avoid a scandal at all costs, wanted to make sure that something actually happened. But my question is this an acceptable way to go about something like that? Seeing that the suspect was a he, was communicating with somebody who I assume was underage. They didn't say that, but if that is the case, obviously that is of major concern. Over a Tor network, which I imagine most people think would be secure, this is evidence that it is not, and that you can definitely be caught doing something on Tor if people with technical knowledge happen to be looking over your shoulder. Are we comfortable, though, knowing that our system might be accessed by somebody, and maybe it's not child pornography, maybe it's some anti-government propaganda or something like that, maybe this person's working for a government? You know, with this kind of access, with this kind of follow-up, it seems that we could be under a different sort of surveillance where, our moral high ground is being judged constantly. I don't know. There's something here that just makes me feel like this could be misused down the road. Rob?
It could definitely be misused, but it's also like any skill set in the hacker toolkit, and I think it's a very hacker thing to do. It's a very hacker mindset thing to do, if you're using the tools available to you, and you see something you want to accomplish, in this case, turning in somebody who seems to be exploiting children, then I think going ahead and using your skills to do that and finding ways to do that while protecting yourself. This person like took the initiative and reported it and so on and negotiated their immunity. I think it's a very hacker thing to do. You don't have to put on a Batman suit to, you know, get a little vigilanteing done if you think it's the right thing to do.
Well, it happened in the very first episode of Mr. Robot, so yeah, it is a very hacker thing to do. But it's also a very hacker thing to question everything and to say, well, is it possible to, say, plant something on someone's computer and then make that report? You know, somebody with the right skills can make you seem guilty of almost anything if they have an agenda, and we certainly have seen people with agendas in the past. Kyle.
Oh, I think that what you're hitting on is this sense of vigilantism. The same thing I was saying earlier, like, oh well, you know, we're potentially at some kind of conflict with this country or these countries or all the countries, and so therefore I can just go and act nationalistically. Or in this case, well, you know, everybody probably has. I need to check everybody's computers and all the phones. Me personally, because I take an interest in this kind of thing, I have the skills, so I just want to make sure no one has this on their phone.
It'll only take a moment.
When I'm done, we'll know.
Yeah, and the other thing that concerns me are conspiracy theorists that believe that there's child exploitation happening everywhere and use that as a vehicle to get, I'm thinking QAnon, I'm thinking Pizzagate. You know, people like that, imagine with technical ability, that say, yeah, there's proof, here it is, I'll just put it on here. You know, we have to be very careful going down this road. Alex, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, on that point, I entirely agree. I think we do have to be really careful about going down this road, because I think we don't want to encourage this kind of vigilantism. It's one thing, I think, to be spelunking around or looking and exploring systems, coming across CP or child pornography and reporting it to the authorities. I think that's one thing. But then actively going and hunting for systems, mining people's data, looking for your criminal activities, I think that's really, really dangerous thing to consider, to encourage. And I think that's why prosecutors have to be very, very careful about granting immunity to this type of vigilantism in particular. But also one really, really important thing to remember in this particular case is that if the government wanted access to this individual's computer at Middlebury University in Vermont, they would have had to do so on showing, they would have had to acquire a warrant.
That's right.
On showing a problem.
This is a quick way around all that. We're out of time, unfortunately. We can continue this on overtime. Join us online. We'll be able to continue it there. Go to 2600.com, click on the link there to join us at 8 o'clock. Hey, we're about to embark on a really interesting project starting tomorrow, where we're releasing some lost audio from various radio shows and presentations. Be doing it every day starting tomorrow. It's going to go into October. That's how much we have. So 2600.com/audio-segments. Go there to get updates. Every day we'll be releasing something. We are not on next week, but we'll be back in 2 weeks. OTH at 2600.com. See you on Overtime. Good night.
There's no song for the singer, no words for the tune. There's a mess in the message and a man on the moon. There's no plan in the planet. There's a milk bottle shortage, and the traffic lights don't work. Lie down and be counted. Don't take any more. Lie down and be counted. What are we standing for? But there's hope for the couples who stroll in the park. There's new nuclear power to light up the dark. There's national health and ice in the fridge. And the occasional cow on a motorway bridge. There's extended credit on easier terms. Something to kill. Machine. Stars on
at you. There's a mess in the message and a man on the moon. There's no plan in the planet.